Matthew Dawkins. I am one of your hosts, and here are my co-hosts, Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Eddie Webb.
Hi there.
This podcast, this episode, is a little bit of a special one. It's a bumper interview with the big cheese, the head honcho, the man himself, Rich Thomas, the creative director of Onyx Path Publishing. He is the man that has given us the authority, as well as having the audacity to ask us to make these podcasts weekly, and hopefully that's going down well with you. But we have some questions to ask of him, of his past, of his present, and of the company's future. We'll be grilling him with some of the questions other people are afraid to ask. And, well, tell me, Dixie, are you a bit excited? Are you looking forward to this?
Oh, yeah, I'm very excited. I like talking to Rich at conventions and things. He's always got crazy stories about, you know, working at White Wolf and also just kind of how the company formed. So it's really, it'll be fun to kind of take some of those stories and, you know, give them to the public.
Yeah, hopefully everyone will learn something from this and it'll help you understand the mind behind the man a little more. What about you, Eddie? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, honestly, I've known the guy for well over a decade now, so I've actually heard most of his stories, sometimes many times. But I am curious to see kind of what you guys bring to this. And actually, hang on, I think Rich is calling me in. Oh, he's got me!
Well, that's our cue, ladies and gentlemen. Anyone listening right now, if Eddie has been dragged away, that is the signal. It is time to commence the interview with his abductor, Rich Thomas. Hello, it's Matthew Dawkins here with Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And our guest, the special one, the boss man and the generalissimo, Mr. Richard of House Thomas. Rich Thomas, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
And, well, of course, this is your first time on the Onyx Pathcast. You've spoken to us a lot of times. How do you feel about the audience being able to hear your voice, being able to, in a sense, interact with you directly? Because not every boss, not every creative director of a company has that much contact with their audience.
I mean, we've been doing that for years, though, so it's not that unusual. For me, or I think for anybody who works with Onyx Path, I mean, we've been reaching out to people for a very long time, and really having great conversations with our community during that time. So it's kind of just more of the same and more fun. And you've interviewed me before in your crazy YouTube channel.
Not that crazy. It's slightly eccentric, I suppose. I do pretend to be a vampire sometimes. But don't we all?
Exactly.
The I guess, well, what we have got scheduled for this interview, we do have questions from the audience, and we also have our own questions. Some of this will be freeform. Rich isn't prepped on everything that we're going to ask, so there will hopefully be not too many awkward silences, but if there are, we will have an emergency question to throw in to get things back on track. And I suppose the first question to ask is, with a bit of a preface, we know, most of us know, that you started off with White Wolf Publishing. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
And what was your title when you first started with White Wolf?
Ooh, way back, I think it was just straight up art director.
And how long did you retain that position?
So when White Wolf was growing, it was growing at a crazy pace, like 300% a year. And the needs of management continued to grow, so the titles continued to change and mutate like a horrible creature. And so there was all kinds of titlings that went on. Senior art director, there was one about production and design, vice president of production and design, I think. There's just, you know, bup, 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 bup. So, I mean, basically, I was hired in originally to oversee all of the visuals that, and was responsible for all the visuals that would come out of White Wolf. And that didn't change. Just more and more people were hired on as art directors and designers and other things as we grew and grew and grew, and I was continuing to manage all those folks. So the titles kept changing. The responsibility ultimately always came down to making sure that the stuff that we were putting out was as gorgeous and on time was another big part of what I was supposed to be doing as we could make it.
So there's going to be a lot of people who listen to this who aren't going to necessarily know what an art director does, or rather what you have done specifically where in your work with White Wolf or before or surrounding it. And I mean, I know and Dixie knows you've drawn, you have illustrated for Magic the Gathering, you've contributed illustrations to the White Wolf magazine, and of course to a number of the World of Darkness games and subsequent Chronicles of Darkness games too, to large and small degrees. Can you name any specific pieces or describe them that people might know you from as an artist?
Well, certainly the original Vampire the Masquerade, the little storyline that was going on at the bottom of all the pages. My section of that, I think, was the last third, I think it was. Which is much more the, at that time, and in, for that particular project, I was working in an ink wash style, so it's a lot of grayscale. I have one piece from that that I tried to get into all the editions that we did, which was the vampire crying the blood tear, kind of looking up at the face and everything. And so that's one that people might have seen just because we stuck it in a bunch of issues. Vampire First, Vampire Second, and Revised at least, I think. And then I think I got it into V20. So that was that would be a memorable one. I actually, because of the way things timed out, did many more illustrations for Werewolf in the beginning of Mage, at least Mage, the first edition of Mage. What was that? Mr. Wrinkle? Was he just Wrinkle? But it was, I think it was a paradox spirit or something that was all wrinkly, and it was a lot of fun to draw. So slightly different style. And that's one of the things, that my style tends to be pretty variable depending on what project I'm working on. With Magic the Gathering, I was very lucky to be in there at the beginning. One of the, what they, I think they call the first 49, 49 artists who worked on the first set. And the Blue Elemental Blast, the Red Elemental Blast, which I think was at least of a couple years ago, they were still actually, it was actually still in the decks, still a legal modern deck. And then Black Vice was the big famous one. That was the one that really everybody seemed to relate to. They all seemed to like the little stuffy doll guy who's stuck in the vice. And then of course I had to put him into other things as I did more art for Magic and do worse things to him, have him ripped apart and set on fire. And
poor guy.
Yeah, little guy. But you know, it's what the public demanded. So, that was sort of the one that people kind of come up to me and ask me to sign those cards over and over again. Yeah. So I have to assume that people like something about it. Maybe it's just that it's a really great they're great cards to play. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of nostalgia, obviously, for the earlier Magic cards. There's a lot of really great and really interesting art that went on with them. But also, I think it's interesting because I know a lot of folks, like fans, and even myself for a long time, didn't realize that your background was art, because I knew you as Onyx Path Publishing and the creative director. So I thought of you more as like, you know, words than art.
Well, I mean, I was trained through till college as a classic artist, you know, doing painting and drawing in a fine arts sense, and then decided when I went into college that I would like to eat, and didn't want to. I was a good waiter, but I didn't want to be a waiter all the time. So, studied graphic design and a lot of art direction. School that I went to had that as an offering, and I took a lot of courses, kind of fell more into the art direction end of things for a while, and wound up when I graduated going into doing ad work and online work for an online being television, sorry, not This is before doing television graphics, particularly news graphics. So those little, you know, broken windows or, you know, blood splatters across murder scene behind a guy's head. I used to do those in Philadelphia. So
that's so interesting because, like, it's one of those things that everyone's familiar with, but I don't think many people think about the people actually creating them.
Yeah, it was crazy. In fact, I was just out to a dinner with one of our friends from that time period, who was an engineer and was the guy responsible for two things. One, I brought the first desktop publishing system into Philadelphia Television, and it included a 3D rendering program. And it was not one of those things where you could render right to your hard drive. The hard drives then couldn't hold the rendered stuff. It had to render to a tape machine, and because of the union, it had to render to a tape machine run by one of their guys. I couldn't do it myself. And so we had this very complicated system of working with this one guy, and he was a younger guy who got what it is I was trying to do. So it was great to talk to him. And one night he said, "Hey, man, I'm going to be away for the weekend." I'm like, "I've got this animation; it's really important." And he's like, "Don't worry, I've got there's another engineer. She was hired the same time that I was. She's really smart. I told her what to do. It'll work out just fine. It'll be great." And we went down there and started rendering. And just was talking a little bit, and several weeks later, I asked her out on a date, and that's my wife, Lisa, and we're 25 years later, still together.
I didn't know that story either. That's adorable. Yeah,
that's why I love Lisa. So yeah, but that's
so you've had a
good Matthew.
Well, yeah, you've been around the block a bit, as one might say. In the sense of your progression into this industry, and I guess once you entered it in the early 90s, here's a cutting question: have you ever thought, nope, that's it, right, I'm getting out of RPGs completely, this is done for me?
I don't think that was the exact mental place I was at with joining the World of Darkness MMO team when CCP and White Wolf had merged. I was running all of what White Wolf Publishing was at that point, with our little team that had stayed in that area, and was asked to come over and work on the MMO. And I had to think about it relatively hard, but the idea of finding out. Like, I always say this thing, it sounds incredibly stupid, but I'm going to say it anyway. How does it know that I want to run across that field?
Right.
Like, I really want to know, how do these sprites come together and do the things that show up in when I'm playing, you know, at the time, EverQuest or World of Warcraft. So it was like, you know, I wanted to know how that worked out, and I wanted to help out the MMO team. They were really asking for help, and I didn't want to leave RPGs per se, but the idea of a whole other area where, you know, could make a mark and maybe do some fun stuff, that was certainly compelling. And that was the only real time I've left RPGs, and as we could look back on history, that only lasted for a certain amount of time. And then I jumped back with working on the Vampire 20th Anniversary Edition and realized how much I loved doing it. And decided it was time that I needed to do it all the time.
So. Right. Those are interesting questions when it comes to MMOs and stuff, though, because I think a lot of people don't think about all the little programming and questions that go into them. You know, open your game and you either press your controller or you hit W to walk forward, and that's just getting normal now. But I like
to know how things work, you know, particularly creative things like that.
Right. So what brought you, like, talk a little bit, I know you talked about it before, but maybe a little bit about the formation of Onyx Path as a company. I know it's kind of been covered, but since you are the right guy, as it were. And also, even, like, is there a story behind the name? Because I've never heard one personally.
Oh, yeah. So, It was a, it, it brings up a lot of, it brings up a lot of, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, really. But
I don't want to do that to you. I'm going to get a podcast, obviously.
It was a pretty tough. Well, if you talk to anybody, talk to Mike Chaney. I mean, there's. It was really a rough time. It was a rough time for particularly people who'd been through White Wolf, devoted a lot of their lives to making it the awesome place that it was and the incredible
right.
worlds that we had created together. And then working on the MMO was a little bit of a bad time. I don't, you know, no fingers to be pointed on that, but it was just not fun.
Like, and I actually remember that when White Wolf kind of got shut down, you know, after a while. I remember even being sad because I actually at the time had kind of an ambition to work there one day. And I was like, aw, I'm never going to do that now, you know?
Well, you know, we've got some options now, Dix.
Yeah, right?
but so we were doing that stuff. And the thing for me and why it was particularly hard for me is that in order to do this, to be part of the MMO team, you had to live in Atlanta. And right. I had moved from Atlanta to back up to Pennsylvania 4, 5, 6 years earlier. My kids were well entrenched in school and what they were doing. I have a personal feeling that the schools up here in Pennsylvania are better than the schools in the Atlanta area. Sorry, Atlanta. You've got some extraordinary schools, I know. But in general, when we moved up, my daughter, when she went to her high school, was she had to scramble to catch up to the kids,
right?
That were in the just in terms of what they know, what they've been taught. So, didn't really want to move the whole family back down to Atlanta. So the deal that I made with them was to live in Atlanta 3 weeks out of every month, and 1 week I'd be back home, attending teleconferences and stuff like that. Still working, right? It wasn't vacation week. It was
right.
still a work week. But I'd be in my house with my kids and the whole family. So I committed to doing that for 2 years and maybe 2.5 years if the release date was in sight. And it got
that
to two
sounds
and a half.
Rough.
It was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. I mean, Lisa was basically a single parent for 3/4 of every month. And as much as we tried to stay connected, and we'd have dinner together. They'd have the computer pulled up to the table, and Cyber Dad was there because we'd Skype while we were having dinner. It was still just absolutely brutal. And got to 2.5 years, and they said, "Well, we're probably at least a year out." And I said, "I can't. I gave it all I could give it, guys." And so that was when. V20 was starting to actually get some incredible response, and I said, "Look, you know, why don't I do this? Eddie Webb would like to do a transmedia group. He and I could do this together. We'll do other things. We'll do more books for Vampire 20th. We'll do any sort of publishing stuff that you guys want to do in house. There's like, so we did a little thing for a brochure for Eve, things like that." And that's what I was doing when the big layoffs came. And from my perspective, seeing people that were from the old White Wolf that I had hired personally 15 years earlier now
right.
start now be on the cutting block, I was like, I can't do this. I can't do it. He's like, "Well, yeah, actually, Rich, you know, we'll need you to be involved with Eve more." And it's like, you know what, I should go. And I was talking to Mike Tinney, who was the president of the North American branch of CCP, which was, you know, White Wolf, and he said, "Look, Rich, let me talk to these guys and we'll get you a good thing." So, because I said I want to start my own RPG company, and I said, "Okay, well let me talk to these guys about a license." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Maybe we could get a license for some of the games, and then you'd have something to start with." I was like, "Yes, that would be great." So, previous to that, when we were doing the various transmedia stuff, I pitched an idea to Mike about a sort of a subscription service for real, you know, more hardcore White Wolf fans that was going to be called the Onyx Tier.
Okay.
And the Onyx Tier was, you know, black and scary. And And it was going to be something where, you know, they could subscribe to the things we were putting out, but they'd also get insider stuff, things like that. Just kind of using we wanted to use the internet as the base for that. And so when I left, I was like, you know, I'm just going to start this new company. And it was actually Tinny who said, well, you're going to take that Onyx thing. I was like, yeah, but I can't take Onyx Tier. That doesn't sound like a company. It's more like an Onyx Path, really, because I don't know where I'm going. and he was like, "I like hey, that's good. I like that." Yeah. So that's actually where the name came from. It was mostly, and it, as a metaphor, it was I was taking this huge step into the unknown, into the darkness,
right.
And all I could see was these very faint glimmers of where I might go along this kind of path as I work my way forward. So it was both something that just came out of bopping ideas back and forth with Mike, but also really was evocative of where I was mentally. And there's been a few times when I've thought, what is happening here? Why? What am I doing? I mean, wait a minute, you're on a path, man. It's a path in the dark, and it's cool. Okay.
I think that's worked out rather well, hasn't it?
So far, so good. Yeah. You know, that's what they said to the guy who'd fallen out of the 80-story building on the way down.
So far, so good. So
how
far,
you doing?
So, good.
So far, so good.
So I've got one question for you about the White Wolf era, and then we'll move on to modern events. And I'm going to ask you this question, although I already know the answer. At least I think I know the answer. And that's because I think this is something a lot of people don't know. And it's regarding what was at that point called the New World of Darkness and is now called the Chronicles of Darkness. So quite a lot of the time, the claim gets thrown at games like Vampire the Requiem, Werewolf the Forsaken, and so on, that they killed White Wolf. And this recently came up on the Onyx Path forums. And you swiftly swooped in to disabuse people of the notion. But there's this idea that the New World of Darkness was a sales failure, a marketing failure, and it completely murdered White Wolf Publishing. And I happen to know that that wasn't the case, but I was wondering if, from the horse's mouth, as it were, what was the situation? How did the company build up to what became known as the New World of Darkness and is now Chronicles of Darkness? And what effect would you say it had on the lifespan of White Wolf?
Well, Wilbur...
Whoa!
From the horse's
Horse
mouth.
14 years ago.
Yes. So I did really feel like I mean, people have their own feelings about it, and there's absolutely no point in trying to argue someone about their feelings. I mean, you feel like the New World of Darkness came in and destroyed the world that you had devoted, you know, years and years and years of your efforts and your creative experience into, and I can't make that better for you or give you an explanation that's going to be satisfying. But the idea that the New World Darkness killed White Wolf, though, that was something I felt I had to step in and say no. I mean, you know, there's so many other things that are coming into it, and the funniest thing of that whole discussion that was on the forums is simply that I wasn't even pro New World of Darkness when it was. I was one of the people arguing against moving to the New World of Darkness back in the day. I was just fine with doing a fourth edition and you know, there was nothing wrong with that. Call of Cthulhu's had 11 editions. I don't know, you know. People understand, it'll be great. But the biggest argument against it was that just doing a fourth edition was continuing to give us diminishing. It would just continue to give us diminishing returns. We'd have a spike with the initial books, and then everything would kind of settle down to where sales numbers were for the World of Darkness, which were not great at that point. I don't know if we were oversaturated. I don't know. I really don't know why sales were going the way they were. I do know that game stores were going out of business on a daily basis. Bookstores, the chain stores, were falling. I think somebody gave us some numbers a while back, and not being a huge numbers guy, I may not be able to remember this exactly, but there was something like we lost 700 bookstores like in 1 year.
Right.
Those are our two big venues. I mean, drive-thru was not a big thing. It was getting it out into the game stores and the bookstores. So comic book stores, you know, included with game stores and stuff. So there was a marketplace collapse that was occurring. We knew we were getting hammered by the nascent computer game MMO market that was coming on very strong. Since most of us were playing one or several MMOs,
right.
we kind of knew that people were doing it, and that simply was taking time away. Plus, it gave you the ability to hook up with friends in groups, kind of the same way getting together at your house and playing would. So there was a lot of factors that went into it, and it was felt at the time that if we just did a fourth edition, we would just kind of go up and then come back down to where we were. And, you know, okay, we could drift along for a little while later, but at what point does it become something where we have to start firing people and doing layoffs and stuff? And we're really trying to take care of everybody because we're not huge at that point. We're nowhere near the size we were at our maximum. So there's we don't really want to get rid of anybody. So New World Darkness was proposed. Destroy everything with a gun. And there was certainly a level of cinematic satisfaction with the idea of all the Gehennas and apocalypses all smashing into things. Whoa, this thing is done. Yeah, they actually had completed a story. That's pretty cool. For RPGs and RPG settings and worlds, maybe not the best approach. And so what happened was that New World Darkness hit huge. The first, I mean, you know, huge. stuff was selling like crazy, and then the supplements dropped back down to where World of Darkness was, and then ultimately, or where it had been, and then ultimately down even below that, as either this continuing erosion of the marketplace occurred, or people decided, no, I don't really want this, and went back to playing, you know, Vampire Second Edition or whatever they were, you know, what their chronicles were set in. And anyway, that I don't think it killed White Wolf. I think it by not being a home run, it contributed to sort of an inevitable erosion of what we were. Whether it was a good idea to do the new World of Darkness the way we did it and all those other sort of factors, those are very debatable things, but I just don't see that. I don't see that we didn't gain what we hoped we were going to gain, but I don't think we lost what we lost based on the New World of Darkness.
So on to the present era, Anonix Path Publishing, and we've spoken about its genesis. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know what Onyx Path Publishing is. So we're not going to go into how we produce our books. We've got other podcasts for that. So we're not going to go into Drive-Thru RPG, where you can buy the majority of our products or anything like that. But what I would like to know, and I guess this is more of a creative question, is since Onyx Path Publishing's foundation, let's think of three. Rich, can you name so far in this company's relatively short history three highlights creatively that Onyx Path has hit for you? Three things that you look on with absolute pride, or if pride is too strong a word, satisfaction that yes, this is the kind of thing we want to be doing in the future.
Well, boy, that's interesting. Because, I mean, yeah, I could give you my personal kind of, hey, I'm really glad we did this. Or I could look at it more from the, as a publisher, what was good things for us to do. But I'm just going to, as usual, as you both of you are well aware, I'm just going to sort of spew a bunch of thoughts and...
that's all right. We'll edit them out.
Yeah. It's put in verbal bullet points.
Anybody ever knows what wants to know what it's like to be in the Monday meeting? It's just Rich viewing thoughts for 2 hours.
Exactly. In no particular order. the full metal die cut through Werewolf's Ultra Deluxe, the Werewolf 20th anniversary's Ultra Deluxe, was something I had wanted to do with the original Werewolf, and being able to do it because of the support of the Kickstarter backers was phenomenal. That very, very difficult to find a way to do it, but we eventually did, and I'm very, very thrilled with that. You know, that's a nice thing when you have a creative idea and it can't do it. We can't do it. I'm so frustrated. But we put it aside for a while, and then, you know, 20 years later, huh, look, technology says we can do this. Let's do it. I think I very much enjoyed working on Pugmire with Eddie. That has been mm-hmm. that has been a lot of fun, and it's also really, really always enjoyed world building. It was one of my favorite things to do back in the day with White Wolf. As we started to actually create worlds versus populate a world that's just like ours except darker, I was involved in all the creative teams that did Exalted and the original Aeon and pretty much everything from that point on. Scion. So those are things that world building aspect of it is a lot of fun. And I think being able to come back in and bring original creators back to the things they worked on many, many years ago for, you know, there's challenges. We've definitely had our challenges working with that, but having Justin do Vampire after Justin was not doing Vampire for a long time, and having Rich Dansky, the original Dead Guy, being the developer for Wraith 20, and Ethan was the, you know, developer for Werewolf and all of its guises for so long, and then having him do Werewolf 20 was, you know, that was a lot of fun. And for me personally, along the same lines of thinking, was being able to reach out to my old art guys, my old illustrators, who I hadn't worked with for years and years and years, that I had, you know, weekly minimum conversations with back in the day, and now here we are working on new art for some of these editions. That was phenomenal. I'm really pleased and very proud of the second editions of all the Chronicles of Darkness, and I actually like that we moved to the Chronicles of Darkness to differentiate the New World Darkness even more. I love the second editions. There's a lot of stuff that I had tried to, because again, at the time that we were doing the New World of Darkness, the first editions of those games like Requiem, I was in charge of visuals still, so I could put my two cents in as a manager and a member of the management team, but I couldn't really make the text be what I thought it should be. And going into the second editions, I could work with Rose to kind of go through and say, look, this thing always bothered me. And anybody who's ever heard me talk to Eddie, invariably we will get to what things don't you like. And one of them that was a big one for me was the Predator's Taint in Requiem. And I just mm-hmm. felt, when I read it the first time, that it set an expectation for the game that was going to overpower what people were really trying to do with it. And I tried to talk to Justin about it. He and I have been on panels where we've argued this particular thing. His thing was, it's a sidebar. It's said to be optional. I said, it's written down and people are going to think this is the thing. And by being able to move that away from Requiem was, that was pretty satisfying. And I think this is going to make this better for everybody. So things like that.
Okay, so while you've mentioned about the creatives bringing people back, like Dansky, like Ethan Skemp, and on the subject of creatives, I guess line developers and the like, as this is the podcast that asks the questions everyone else is afraid to ask, and we're prepared to give you a grilling.
Oh no!
When, yes, that's right. It's the 1-2 punch now.
Matthew wonder, has me in his targets.
I do, yeah. You are locked in my sights. I'm going to ask you about a couple of projects, a couple of lines recently. In fact, a few that have had a key member of staff or key members of staff drop from the project at an inopportune moment, either due to a change in life or a change in business relationship with you. I think that's a kind way of putting it. And rather than getting into any sort of gossip or naysaying, what I'm interested in is the impact that has on you as the creative director of Onyx Path and what impact that has on the company. How do we recover when, without beating around the bush, a game like Exalted or a game like Changeling the Lost, which are pretty high-profile games, lose developers or lead writers or what have you at a midway point during the production process? Because clearly we invest a lot in these lines. So what do you do to handle this kind of thing? And how do we ensure that we're taking the right course following a departure like that?
It's definitely a tough situation all the way around. And as you say, I mean, I've made it. I don't know that I've said it officially out in the world, but our policy on these sorts of things is not to engage in, finger pointing or what's up here. We're going to give you full disclosure because the people need to know. I don't.
Well, yeah, it's unprofessional.
I don't find it to be professional to air those sorts of things, particularly since in any creative endeavor, it's very rare to find someone who's a true villain. It is far more likely that everyone involved thinks they're doing the very best they can, and that everybody feels mistreated by the other party to some degree. So, what I prefer to do is to try to find a solution. And in some cases, what we've definitely tried to do, we've evolved sort of a system in the company now that the two of you are involved with now, which is finding ways to adjust what any given developer is doing so that their strengths are being manifest, and if they have areas where they're not as strong or that they for a lot of different reasons can't do that part of development, bringing in someone or someones who can step in and help out. So that's like sort of that's the bigger that's the non-band-aid solution is to make sure that we don't run into these situations again because we're providing people with help, but inevitably we will, and it is a tough thing. Ultimately, you try to get the best people on it with to pick up the the project where it is and move it forward. And sometimes you have to move back to a part where they can best start to get involved with it, put their own creative stamp on it. Sometimes it can be more of a smoother handoff, but it's never an easy handoff, and it is always fraught with the sort of creative and economic balance issues that all of publishing has. You know, how creative can we go? How long can we allow people to continue to find ways to exercise their creativity better or more when we also have an obligation to actually publish and to get this thing into the hands of the community and let it be the game we all hope it will be. So it's when we have these things, the first thing we try to do, whatever, there are problems, there's always problems, this is the nature of people working together, particularly creative people, is to keep communication open, to give people good lines of communication, and to keep an understanding. And if that goes wrong, if it gets weird, or it's just there's no real resolution, so-and-so simply cannot produce the thing that we're looking for. It is a very hard call because, again, you're going to have to go back to some extent. You're going to have to stop the forward progress.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it was glacially slow forward progress, but it was forward progress nevertheless. And from working with a single or several minds who have an idea of where they're trying to get to bring in a new group, new person, and say, now you get it to this point. It is you're always going to be losing months of time, and that's, you know. So again, like I say, it goes back to that balance of, well, is it better to lose months of time and get this thing to the point it needs to be, satisfies what we are trying to publish, and in a reasonable amount of lateness, or do we continue on with the situation, maybe not get what we want, maybe even goes later, maybe eventually, you know, we look at the same amount of time and go, nothing has occurred. We don't, you know, you don't know what your situation is there. And massive judgment calls. I wish it was as simple as saying, you're late, I'm firing you. But A, I don't like doing that. B, I don't think that's fair. Because we're talking about creative people who are trying to create in the midst of everything else that's going on in their lives. It's not just somebody down the hallway who's employed by the company and this is what they do 8 hours a day.
Right.
You know, it's a much it's a more complex situation when everyone you're working with is freelancers. And so I like to keep that in mind. And then finally, if you just fire someone straight off, there are all kinds of ramifications. There's ramifications to the project itself, like I just was talking about. There's employment and legal ramifications that, you know, and now as everyone, you know, is aware of all the opportunities that people have to air their commentary and their grievances, there's ramifications to the community. So,
right,
it's. Because I was, you know, especially like we have a couple people on the who backing the Wraith 20 Kickstarter. Wraith 20 is very late. The majority of that problem has been because Rich Dansky's job, instead of getting lighter, which is what we had anticipated when he was originally hired for it, it was they actually, all the quiet that was going on that Rich thought was meaning they were going to tell him he wasn't going to be doing as much, was actually them putting together plans to tell him he was going to be doing twice the amount of work that he was doing at the time, and flying him all over the world and all kinds of stuff like that. So everything that could happen that goes wrong. And at the time, Rich was pretty insistent that he had it under control and he could keep going. He's an old hand, and I felt that he, you know, had a better take on that than anybody stepping in could. And then, of course, having that his overall feel for Wraith, and that was what we had gone to the Kickstarter for, and had a few backers who were very, very vocal about when this thing started going late that he should just be fired. Just get rid of him. So, well, I'm not going to do that. So now I'm the bad guy, right? Because I didn't fire this guy who's probably the best expert on Wraith there is. So yeah.
Well, yeah, you have to take a risk. You take a gamble. You decide, is his creative vision more important than getting it out on time? And I mean, I would say, you know, with a certain amount of bias, I guess, because I worked on the book, that it was worth keeping him around. It's definitely always worth keeping Dansky around, because the work that he does is superb. And it's taken a while to incorporate the errata we've received for that book, but thank goodness that we got the errata that we did. It's an interesting. It's very interesting the way these relationships with developers and writers work out, the way we handle them, the balance between maintaining, I guess, professional coolness and also wanting to maintain personal relationships and that kind of thing. I guess that in a sense that's similar in any company, any business, but in the RPG industry where we all pretty much know each other, we all go to the same right. conventions, and you know, we may not be working with each other for this company, but we'll probably be working with each other for another company. Some people describe it as incestuous, but there's definitely a different culture to the way you might either terminate someone's contract, to use some very harsh words, the way you might ease someone off and replace them with another, or retain them as you do sometimes because you're determined to cling to their vision of what the game's going to look like. I suppose, in a way, and it sounds a little airy to say it, there isn't a right or wrong. It's a case-by-case basis.
It's very case-by-case, and sometimes you're dealing with people who whose own self-image is tied into what's happening. You know, again, I try to be as sensitive as we can be for what will allow us to have as much of someone's creative abilities being applied to the project as possible. And some people do thrive under incredible tension and stress. It's a heck of a lot more creative people who just dry up. And so we try to walk that and find a good way to do that. And I think your example, Matthew, actually of the work that you are doing with Rich now, to fill in some of those gaps that he can't hit himself because of the circumstances of his day job, is part of what we've tried to evolve into, and that's one of the things that, you know, as a whole, I like to point out about Onyx and what we do is that we're not locked into this is our procedure and we're always going to do it this way and be damned with you if you can't, you know, deal with it.
Right.
We're always listening. We're always, you know, trying to find better ways to do what we do, trying to find new configurations. The recent move with having the two of you and Eddie as sort of in-house freelance developers who are able to help out and jump in on things because of the ongoing relationship, that's a big big shift, but I think a really, really positive one, and we're already seeing the results of that with things like, I mean, I don't know how long the errata for Wraith could have taken if we hadn't moved to this and if you were not there hammering away in the errata mines, but it definitely would have taken longer. We know that. we just know that that would have been the case.
Well, I'm going to break the tone now with an emergency question.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so prepare thyself.
Something fun and wacky.
Oh, right. Well, I may have to go for another one. Nope. okay, well, I'll give you two. First one is, would you rather be a cow or a badger, and why?
All right. Okay. I think I'd rather be a badger. Let's see, because unlike the cow, I make my own decisions about things. I don't live or die at the whim of some, you know, dirt clad farmer, or Texan cattle baron. I will react to things and do things based on my my slightly aggressive nature, and I don't want to give milk.
I think that's a fair judgment. And okay, here's another one. This is one that was supposed to go to Ian, and was asked of him when recording had stopped. I understand, so it's now being redirected to you, Rich.
All right. So thank you so much, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So the question is, do you think the plot of the Tim Allen movie The Santa Claus could ever happen in real life?
I don't know who's listening. I'm going to assume that probably not kids. But if there are any kids listening, earmuffs.
I hope not.
See, because there's no Santa. Right? Like, he doesn't exist. So, it couldn't, because the plot is predicated on the existence of Santa.
What a killjoy you are, Rich. So,
sorry, but you know it's
no,
it's all this darkness. What can I tell you?
There's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. There's only the answer you come.
I'm wearing my black cape, and my official vampire candles are going. And...
I would like to talk a little about the projects that are upcoming for Onyx Path. These days, some people who have worked with you, Rose Bailey and Eddie, of course, with Bugmite, and me with They Came From Beneath the Sea, so Rose's was Cavaliers of Mars, we will pitch an idea to you, and if you like it, you will enter into an agreement with us, an arrangement, a legally binding contract that will differ depending on the nature of the game and what your vision is for it. What is it that drew you to those three games in particular? Because they're all three of them, in the case of Pugmire, of course, that's out. Monarchies of Mao will be out very soon. And Cavaliers of Mars isn't too far away, and They Came From has just moved over to you and Eddie for what is essentially manuscript approval. So what drew you to these three games?
Well, I'll do it chronologically. Cavaliers was the first thing, the first independent non-White Wolf IP project that was pitched to me. It was pitched fairly early on. I don't want to say within weeks of announcing I was going to do it, but pretty early. Roses had it in her head for quite a while, and I really liked it because it was a very, very tightly focused concept on you know, Rose likes pulp heroes. Rose is a modern person. Rose has a way to bring the pulp hero things that we like into a modern role-playing game, and it's on Mars. And then finally she ended it with a tagline that I always like a tagline. I like to have something that can get people's imaginations going before they even know what the thing's about. And hers was, and I'm paraphrasing, if Mars has canals, Mars must have a Venice.
Right.
And that was like, yeah. Now that brings it into a zone where people like all the highfalutin stuff we might be thinking about, and she was working on multiple systems, some of which were including special dice and you know, things like that. That to some extent she actually came back to ultimately, but this was much more convoluted. She was trying to get to work because Rose loves to figure out how to better weld the system and the setting together.
Yeah.
And so that was really interesting. Plus, knowing that Onyx needed to grow, even something that I always saw Cavaliers as, I've told Rose this a million times, I saw it as a jewel box. As a very, very personal, I mean, you know, she has no objections calling it a fantasy heartbreaker. It's something she's had in her mind for a long time, and we could make it happen, and we could make it look really good with the expertise that Onyx has. And so for me, it was like, okay, well, this will be our first thing like that. And because she was so, you know, personally involved with it and so interested in it, it also made me think about the idea of doing some games where we didn't own the property. We didn't license the property per se. We partnered up with a creator and created this thing. And I really liked that, the creator-owned aspect of what we could do, which is something that we would pretty much not have done in the White Wolf days. So it was a way that I saw of starting to adapt to other things we could do because of our size and my personal ability to just go, yeah, let's do that. Didn't have to have a committee meeting for it, so that was pretty cool. Then, like I said, Pugmire, Eddie gave me the pitch to Pugmire. I read the pitch. I got to the Code of Man, and I just started both laughing and going, oh, this is a winner. I don't know how to tell you any other way, but it felt right. And he was sending it to me as a friend to check it out. And I said, is this a pitch for Onyx? Would you want to work with me on this? And if you don't, you have to promise me I can draw for it. because if I can't publish it, I sure as hell want to do some illustrations of these fantasy dogs. I thought.
Yeah, I actually saw the pitch for Pugmire because he was showing it to me as like an example, and yep. Yeah, it's really good. I was like, yep, I would have wanted this.
it was totally a good thing. Once, like I said, the Coda Man was what made it for me, because that just, it seemed to encapsulate in a very literal form the lives these dogs were leading at this point in their mm-hmm. in their civilization and their development. So that was really, really big. And then Matthew, when you pitched They Came From, it was a slightly harder sell. Part of it was because time frame wise, I was concerned it was going to bump into the Trinity Continuum, which was already in my mind as what we've now revealed it is, which is that the Trinity Continuum, the settings will be all throughout history and stuff, forward and backwards. And so that was a concern. It really wasn't until we got to the idea of the quips and the interactive nature of the game is providing you with some of these that are basically canned, but you choose when to put them in, and then it gives you good things back. And it's not just your character necessarily, other characters is the one you're focusing on, but you can be throwing some of these things out just to amuse the people at the table. And the idea, I always say that comedy is one of the hardest things to make work in an RPG creation.
Right.
Because people will, no matter how serious the game, somebody's going to crack a joke at that table. But to program it in, to make it happen, very, very hard. And there's the handful of games that make it actually work are very limited. And the one that comes to mind always for me that is built into it is Paranoia.
Yeah.
Right.
Where, you know, the entire concept is skewed that way, and so I've always been we were trying to figure out how to deal with the fact that the Buffy RPG was such a good RPG, and it was around the same time we were having some issues with, you know, hey, our sales aren't where we want them to be, and damn that they're doing Buffy, son of a, and so put more humor into vampires. Like, no, because if you put the funny in, people can't take the funny out. But if you play it straight, people can put the funny in and will, whether it's just, you know, continual Monty Python references or whatever.
That's a big discussion with Pugmire. I mean, that we talk about with people is like, don't, like, Eddie just did a blog post about it recently. That was like, mm-hmm. This is why it's not a funny dog game. But also people are still going to make jokes.
Right. I mean, the very first thing that happens with Pugmire is that people all do the dog things like, I go around and sniff his butt. I meet him and I sniff his butt. You know, and it's totally understandable because, you know, we're fascinated by our little friends and we see their behavior. And we want to emulate that in a game where we're playing a dog, you know, magic user or whatever. But inevitably after the first 10, 15 minutes of that kind of doggy humor, people start to really run with the concept, and then they start to see the underlying pathos behind it and a lot more of the possibilities of it. For They Came From, once we had the idea that we had a way to get humor into the game that didn't set the tone of the game in the book itself or in the setting itself. It set the tone of the game on, you know, you as a player could dial that back and forth really easily depending on how you handled using those things. So I haven't read it yet, so I don't know if people put stupid puns in it yet, but I will. And
oh, undoubtedly. But but no, you're right, and I guess to chime in on it, as something of an authority on the game, the trick I find, and through all the playtesting I've done with it, is to pitch to players that They Came From is a game that embraces meta, in that your players can significantly alter what's going on in the scene. So it's not necessarily your characters can do it. Your characters have powers. The players also have powers. And the quips are kind of a cross between the two, because a player may utter a quip, which is a one-liner, a glib comment that can be prescribed from a deck of cards or randomly rolled from a table. at a completely inappropriate moment, but if the people around the table appreciate it, think it was amusing or dramatic to say that alien tastes like Mama's cherry pie, you get bonuses for it. You get rewarded. And you also have your incredibly meta abilities, your cinematics that allow you to insert deleted scenes. So if you forgot to do something in a previous scene, you can now narrate that your character did this because it's a deleted scene. Likewise, you can cut straight to black if you're about to face Centipus, a 100 tentacled octopus that's damn guaranteed to devour you. Cut to black, you appear somewhere else. You don't have to explain how you got out of that situation. Your characters just did, and your characters won't comment on it. It's purely for the players to know, and the characters not. So it plays on the humor that already exists at the table, but puts it in as a mechanic, basically.
Incorporates it, yeah.
Yeah. So with that grandstanding out the way, we should probably have a look at the at the questions that our faithful blog followers and forumite commenters left for us. Dixie, would you like to lead on with the first one? If you have them to hand, or shall I just go straight ahead? I'll charge
it. If you've got them open, go ahead. I have to open them.
I do have them open. I'm a man. I come prepared. So, Rich, first question, most common question, but one I'm sure everyone is dying to hear. Do you have a favourite vampire clan for Masquerade or Requiem? This is from Nicholas Milioni Gravina Abdu.
I deeply enjoy many of his questions over the in our forums and stuff.
There are more,
and I have to go at this with being slightly circumspect, because it's a tough thing for me to say, in that responsible for making sure that they're all cool, and so. To say that, well, I like this one rather than that one, that seems unfair. It's like, which one of your children do you love the most? Really,
but everyone's got a favorite child.
Different situations, different sorts of things. So, people ask us all the time. I know that some people have their canned responses. I'm going to go with a reverse, and I'm going to go with a reverse specifically. Hoping that Neil is listening, because the worst clan ever is the Salubri.
Oh yep. No!
Yep. Yep. I hate
them so much.
Soul
tried
devouring,
to kill them off.
Yeah, Diablerist scum.
Oh.
Yeah, the Tremere were too kind.
You know, and every time we tried to kill them off, we ordered Neil to kill them, and he, you know, we wound up having three different kinds in Dark Ages because of it. It's like the Hydra, you cut off the head and you get three more. So yeah, but no, I mean I like I said, I get the question a lot. I've had fun playing most of the Masquerade clans in one form or another. I had some very good fun with playtesting the original versions of Mekkit for Requiem.
Mm. Good choice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Because, I mean, having played the others, I didn't really want to do, I wanted to see what the new thing was going to be more like, you know? I had a great time playing Malkavian, and for Eddie's, Eddie had a long-term online game that we started up around when V20 started. And I think it went on every 4 months-ish, every 3-4 months we get together. And I think it went on for like 3 years.
Wow.
Wow.
But I played this hyper little, kind of the stereotypical stoolie guy. Like I even had a picture of a guy that was the bartender in the demon bar in Buffy.
Oh yeah.
Right.
The little nebbishy little dude. And it was really, really fun to play someone who was getting information that no one else was getting because of who he was and how it affected him. And it was I didn't play him as straight up as an addict, either a blood addict or a drug addict or anything else, but he was definitely of that being compelled sort of thing. And he was good. I mean, a lot of the guys who we were playing with took him as comedy relief because, you know, he'd wind up screwing something up or whatever. We got to the final big showdown, and I think Eddie would correct me if he wasn't in the closet still tied up. I think we were. It was a big showdown with the Sabbat finally showed up, and blah blah blah. And that's who's been behind this all the time. Oh no, blah blah blah. And I did it. I did something where I jumped onto their leader's back and propelled them into one of those fire burning trash cans and held him in there.
Oh, lovely! Like by the ankles.
No, I mean on top of him, like holding onto the sides. I was burning my fingers, but wouldn't, you know, he couldn't get leverage because I was over top of him and holding him in there. And we got done the scene, and it was dead silence. And then Alyssa, who was playing our big tough Bruja, goes, "That's one of the scariest things I've ever been part of. You freaked me out." you just—I mean, I was just listening to what you were saying with Eddie, and Eddie was saying to you, and I just freaked me out. I was like, "I have successfully played a Malkavian."
Right. On to the next question. This one's also from Nicholas. Since Onyx Path was encouraged by White Wolf to pitch V5 supplements, will you pitch them in the future?
Yes.
Well, that was easy. Do you have any in mind, Rich?
Well, I mean, we have several that we are talking to them about, and we have one that was pitched. I don't want to go into the details of where that is or what it's about until we can officially, with all expectation that we're going to move forward with it, announce it. So
I'm here twiddling my mustache right now.
Yes, there's stuff in the making, but there's also. There's also a huge moment that's occurring with V5 that I think White Wolf from Sweden needs a little room to really let that roll and get the word out and stuff like that. And so we'll be talking about what we're up to with the World of Darkness another time, I think.
Yeah. Okay, Second Chances wants to know, what types of characters do you want to run in Pugmire?
I have this idea, and it might be an adventure in and of itself. I'm not sure, and it may take place rather than in Pugmire down at the port city that Eddie has positioned. But I would like to run one of a group of gangster pit bulls who are basically in control of at least the docks, if not the entire underworld, in the thing. And they're all related. They're all family. My pups, way back in the day, I had a brother and a sister. They had 8 siblings, and each one of them was unique. They were so different in their personalities and their markings and stuff, but they all kind of had this shared this slightly pushy attitude, and they were fantastic dogs, and I'd like to work them into a thing and then be able to play one of them, not necessarily the ones that I owned, although I could play Sergeant Pete. That was our male. He was big leather collar with spikes. who wouldn't hurt a fly. Just such a sweet, he was really very much a mama's boy. But not terribly bright, and I think he'd be a lot of fun to play. That's been something that it's been I've been thinking about for a while, of incorporating them somewhere into it.
I am the king of interruptions, so you'll have to excuse that.
Oh, I'll interrupt right back.
You know, we've also, you know, you go ahead, and I'll just keep interrupting you. This will be a perpetual loop, I believe. Uh-huh. This is how we form some kind of time paradox. Anaximander asks, regrets. I've had a few books you didn't do that you should have, books you still want to, but it never seems the right time. This is actually quite a convoluted question. So let's boil it down to, do you have any books that you wish you had released, but you never got the chance to?
Well, I guess the biggie on that one, and again, I don't mean to throw this in because it's just a reality. This is how things happen when you have a license. I was looking forward to doing a Vampire 4th edition, as we announced it, you know. But that was not possible because just as we were gearing up to move even further into it, Eddie had done a bunch of work on preliminary work on it. The whole property was sold to another company who wanted to do their version of a new Vampire the Masquerade, and that seems eminently fair that if you buy something, you should be able to run with it, you know. So, but I would have liked to have been able to have had that come out, because I think we had a lot of good ideas, and some of them, I think, from what I've been able to see from where V5 is going, I think some of the direction that we might have been going in terms of kind of bringing the game into this century, I might see those things in V5 at some point. I might be reading too much into it.
And Tyler asks, do you play Onyx Paths games, and is it weird to play your own properties?
It's not weird for me, in that I think I come at the creation of the games not so much as a game designer, but as a game consumer. So I'm interested in how the whole thing feels. Even when I send notes back, and I know Matthew has certainly seen these, this doesn't feel correct for what you were trying to achieve here versus this is unbalanced, or this plus one should be a plus two, or things like that. So I think it's a little weirder for people who have actually built the nuts and bolts to play these things than it is for me, because I'm into, you know, what kind of great story can we tell. Justin has a great quote, Justin Achille, from one of the conventions we were at, where he said, you know, how many people sit around talking about how 20 years ago they had this amazing dice roll? They talk about what happened. They talk about the event. Oh, my God, this is so cool. And then, you know, we knocked down the prince. Yeah, I can't believe we got, you know, all the... The emotional impact is what I'm looking for from these games. That really is rarely systems-based. The systems get you there, and they're very, very important, but that's not what I usually respond to. So when I'm playing one of our games, I'm having a ball. I usually only really get a chance to do serious playing when we're at a convention, and then I can sit in on something. I've sat in on multiple Dave Martin, The Wrecking Crew, you know, back in the day of... when we would get to conventions, and they'd have an open spot, I could sit in and play Changeling or, you know, whatever. And then play tests. And I sat in on quite a few of the games as we play tested them. So.
Okay. Thomas M. asks, some inside business knowledge here. Have you pitched Hunt of the Reckoning 20, Mummy the Resurrection 20, and Demon the Fallen 20 to White Wolf? And do you have any indication of how likely those projects are to be greenlit?
I don't, you know, it's really up to them. We have submitted many pitches, and those were included in those. We are not working on them currently, so... It is really up to those guys to give us a green light. Those are their intellectual properties, and what we can do with them is what they allow us to do with them.
So. Okay. That of course isn't a direction to you, the listener, to start harassing White Wolf by email, telling them to let Onyx Path do it. But you know, you can if you want. So Yodo asks, not Yoda, although I could do this in a Yoda.
And could you reverse all the nouns and verbs?
Okay.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
Now that Onyx...
Do or do not. There is no try.
Do or do not. Onyx path accurately cannot be described. Darkness world of company.
Anyway, now that Onyx path can't be accurately described as the world of darkness company, how do you hope your fans will describe you or Onyx path as compared to other RPG companies?
Step back on that one a little bit, because it's actually a very pertinent question when you talk about your company and how you want to be perceived. So we spent a lot of time in the first few years of Onyx Path aiming our marketing towards and our PR efforts towards telling people we existed and that we were doing the White Wolf games that they had, you know, that they had loved, and that essentially White Wolf was not dead. Because there was a huge, commentary stream of White Wolf is dead, White Wolf is dead, I said it's dead, blah, 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 blah. And not necessarily that anybody was, you know, wrong for feeling or thinking that, so much as we're here, we're making this stuff, and we think it's really cool. So we were pushing that for a very long time, 2-3 years of solid, this is what we're trying to say. We've begun... once we felt that was working, to move into, we're also doing these other cool things as well. Onyx was always, in my mind, a place where we would be creating really cool worlds and enabling people to enjoy them in a bunch of different ways. Obviously, tabletop RPG being a huge part of that. So the sort of the shepherding of the White Wolf IPs was part of, but not the end all be all for us, and we try to make that pretty clear from the beginning, while we were saying, hey, but we do have them and they're pretty awesome, you should check it out. As we started to actually get more games and get them out there, whether through Kickstarter or in the public eye, try to build that up without losing a focus for, well, then who are these guys? They just put out like any old game. I think we've all seen game companies who have diversified so much that you don't really get them anymore. You just get, I like this game, but maybe not. What are they doing? And so I've tried to be really careful about the kinds of worlds we're creating, the kinds of settings and games that we're offering to the community, and try to keep a little bit of focus on, like I said, that emotional core, that we're not just putting out something because it fills a niche, but because there's a bigger story, something more compelling. Similarly, we were talking about They Came From. Your experience playing that They Came From is probably going to be different than your experience playing, say, a Trinity Continuum Adventure.
Right.
So, you know, kind of the time period thing, because we're going to be providing you with a different world, a world in which you can be really meta in it, and you get benefits from it. So that's a toughie. If we wanted to say, what do people think of Onyx Path? That's the company that puts out that game that I love, would be my thing. Whether that's a license from White Wolf, Exalted, any of the World of Darkness, Chronicles of Darkness, or is it Scion? I love Scion. Oh, they're doing the new Scion. That's what we want. We want people to know that we're treating this thing that they love the way we love it. So.
Okay, we've only got a couple more questions. I'm going to skip another one of Yodo's because we kind of already answered it. So, Yodo, one of your other questions was, as you are the closest thing this company has to its very own Kane, so I guess you murdered someone for this role, which child is your favorite?
So I remember, I read that, and I don't think I'm Kane. More like Methuselah, maybe. I guess, you know, I just think Mark Ryan Hagen would be Kane. But then, child as literally which one of Kane's childer do is my favorite? Me personally, and in that sense, are we talking about games, characters?
Yeah, I was very unsure as to what answer was.
I hate to break apart a parse. No, I thought he was, question.
He was talking about which of your Onyx Parthers. Be it if you are Kane, presumably your child are the other people that work for you and with you. So it's the popularity contest now, Rich, and we're not letting you go until you answer. Which child is your favourite? I know it's not going to be me now.
Okay, specifically between me, Matthew, and Eddie, right?
Yes, yeah, yeah. The rest are siblings, cousins, twice removed, that kind of thing.
Well, remember that last question way back when I said, just like asking you which one of your children is your favourite?
Yeah.
There's no real answer to that.
So is Eddie then. Okay, right, we'll get on to the last one.
I don't think if he was my favorite, I'd have him tied up in a closet, so.
Well, that's why he's tied up in the closet. So, final question from Troy. And then we will conclude with some quick fire questions, as in I will pose say a word. You give an immediate response. You know, psychological test thing. We'll wrap up.
Oh, great.
With psychoanalysis. So, final question here from the fans, which is from Troy. If you could create a product for any property, which property would it be, and what product would it be, and why?
So, yeah, I read that one. I think that was from the blog, and that is, I have been going around on that, and since I read it, it is a really. It's an interesting question, but it's also a really tough one. Like the properties that I really, really love. I mean, you know, things that would be most interesting. I mean, it's nuts. Especially because some of the things that I really love, they've done RPGs for already. Right.
Yeah, so that's my issue with that question. Is I'm kind of like Buffy, Firefly. Wait, is all
exists
to you now?
Exactly. Right. I'm a huge fan of the Black Company books, and of course, Green Ronin did their RPG version of that. And I'm like, yeah, this is okay. I mean, you know, would I like a crack at it someday? Yeah. I feel the same. I mean, you know, if I could get my D&D 6th edition's coming out, but it's published by Onyx Path. You know, I mean. That would be a lot of fun, going back to the granddaddy of it all, you know. We're getting so much more. So here's the thing: when I first started in doing all this stuff, when I was going down to the science fiction bookstore in Philadelphia, which was the only store that only sold science fiction and fantasy, and they were all, you know, mostly hardbacks and a lot of paperbacks just stacked over and over. And you're looking for the yellow spine because that meant it was Daw, and Daw had good things like Michael Moorcock, Elric. The geek community was very encapsulated, and you didn't know that somebody was into it unless you actually saw them walk into that store, you know. And so it was really hard. And In regular media, forget about it. You read comic books? What are you, 7? What's wrong with you? Now I've got this complete collection, and I've got them all polybagged, and they're really cool. Similarly, like I would not have dreamed that I could go into almost any restaurant and go, "Yo, Legolas!"
Yeah.
And people would know who the hell I was talking about.
Yeah, now you do that all the time.
I do, and then I go, "Hey, it's me, Gimli." So, where you been?
You've got Mike with you.
It's me, Gimli. So, when we talk about what kind of property are you really, really into, I could have answered this easier like 20, even 10 years ago when it wasn't, well, maybe 10, 20 years ago, when it wasn't that things are all over the place. Hey, you know one that I'd like to do a role-playing game for? And I know that she says we can never do it, but I'd like to do Harry Potter. It was a role-playing game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that would be quite amazing.
Yeah, but she doesn't like the idea, and you know, I'm sure that at one point one of our vampire LARPs probably interrupted her in some part of her life, and she identifies that with all of our role-playing games now. But
well, we will leave that question at that then. Casting J.K. Rowling under the bus for not having the
pushed
same
under the bus by a bunch
did.
Of guys dressed in black capes. And...
Exactly. So we will finalize with word association to cool down. Following the path of Carl Jung and trying to get a bit of an insight into the crazed mind of Rich Thomas. So he starts with the basics. Home.
Love it.
God. Okay. Mum.
Aw, my mom's dead.
Hero.
Bogart.
Batman.
Hero.
Planet.
Earth.
Gen Con.
See, now I can't say what I normally would say, which was first thing that came to my mind was drinking. but we promised not to stress that aspect of conventioneering.
Mm. Well, no, that you've already answered it now.
I know.
Hoisted by your own pint. vampire.
Bloody.
Drive-thru RPG.
Steve.
Friendly local gaming store.
Oh, man. Rare.
Mark Reinhagen.
So my first thought was, dude.
Chris McDonough.
Which I don't think has any relevance whatsoever, right?
Chris McDonough.
Jackass.
the Wick brothers.
You gotta separate them.
Okay, Stu Wick.
Wonderful, wonderful guy.
Steve Wick.
Terminator.
Eddie Webb.
You know, so the first thought of mine was Pugmire. Wow, I'm conditioned.
Yeah, you are.
And I've known Eddie for 15 years, and that's what came up.
And you know what's coming. Dixie Cockrum.
Awesome.
Matthew Dawkins.
Well, I didn't want to use an English word wrong.
Role playing.
Joyous.
Future.
Ooh, Onyx Path, baby.
Oh, that's a good place to end.
Yeah, I like that.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Rich. This is going to be a bumper sized episode, and I hope everyone enjoys it and has gleaned a lot from your shared wisdom and ravings.
Yeah. If anybody has any further questions and stuff like that, I mean, I'm sure I'll be, you know, when we do it, I'll be announcing it on the on my blog, and there's also, you know, that we announce it on when it comes up. So, you know, any other further questions or extrapolations or anything like that, I'd be glad to go into them.
Exactly. If you want to, you the listener, want to know of anything that Onyx Path are releasing, just check out theonyxpath.com every Monday night or Tuesday morning, and you can see an update every single week of upcoming releases, where they are in the production process, Rich's thoughts regarding current products, and so on, and occasionally guest bloggers too. But Monday evening or Tuesday morning on theonyxpath.com is the place to go to find out about the games we are releasing. And I'm going to say bye-bye, Rich, now, and we will cut to the outro. So, bye-bye, Rich.
Okie doke.
Rich, thank
bye-bye,
you.
Guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
for talking with us.
It was fun.
Well, that's that, then. The interview is concluded. Rich is on his merry way, but I feel, Dixie, like we're missing something or someone.
One yeah, I think... Eddie's still in that cupboard.
Oh, it's one of the adults from Charlie Brown.
True.
Well, I think there's only one thing for it, and because we've not mentioned wrestling so far in this podcast and is now a staple of us to do so, I'm going to have to climb to the top turnbuckle and come down with a resounding elbow drop on the cupboard door. Ooh, yeah! Down I go. Smashing the lock off of the door. Snap into it! And out. Out comes the man of the hour. Miss Elizabeth is actually Eddie Webb.
Next time I'll be drills holes in the cupboard, because it's stuffy in there.
Well, welcome back, Eddie.
Thank you. So that sounded like it was fun, what I could hear through the door.
Well, I had a good time. I enjoyed that a great deal. I want to know, though, Eddie, are the bodies of all of Rich's former colleagues, ex-White Wolfers, ex-Onyx Parthers, in there as well? People who've been stashed away and just forgotten about?
I can either confirm or deny that there are corpses in there.
Oh, well. We'll have
mostly
to...
because I couldn't see them. They're just so dark.
We'll explore that rumor for another day. What happens to an ex-Onyx Partha or ex-White Wolf? But no, I really enjoyed that. Like you said in the intro, Dixie, it is always fun talking to Rich. He's a man who, when you get him on a plane and can start talking. He's running his goddamn mouth and won't stop. But it's always interesting to hear. He always has something innovative to tell us.
Definitely, yeah. I like every time that he tells a story, or you know, read a con for a weekend or whatever. There's always at least one I haven't heard before. Like, I love that he told the story of how he met Lisa, because she's amazing, and that was adorable.
Yeah, I suppose not many people know Lisa, Rich's wife, is in charge of all of our finance at Onyx Path as well, so we have to stay on their good side, really. Rich is the boss. Lisa controls us getting paid, so we love them both dearly. They're lovely, lovely people, and we would never say a bad word about either of them, ever.
Also, if you came to our booth at PAX Unplugged last year, she was working it with me, and she brought cookies, and it was the best thing ever.
Oh, wow.
I missed out on that.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, I got to work with Lisa the whole weekend, and I got to eat about a million pumpkin cookies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to be at PAX this year. I would assume not. And I guess let's close out this podcast by just having a brief discussion. What conventions are we each attending in the next, 6 months or so? Eddie?
Let's see. By the time this goes out, we should be all getting close to Gen Con. I think we're all going to that one.
Mm-hmm.
The big granddaddy convention. Aside from that, though, I will be briefly at a speaker at Broadleaf Writers Conference, which is a conference in Decatur, Georgia. Specifically, I'll be talking about interactive fiction. It'll be the first time the Writers Conference has talked about that particular topic, so that's going to be exciting. And then after that, I'm going to be at Save Against Fear, which is a conference about set by the Budhana Group, and they use tabletop games and role-playing games for therapy purposes. And they're specifically really excited to have Pugmire there because they've had a lot of success using Pugmire in therapeutic settings. So that's going to be really, really exciting.
Yeah, I'm going to be at Gen Con, obviously. And then I will be attending Dragon Con just for fun because I go every year. This will be my 20th Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia. I just go and hang out and have fun.
We'll have to have coffee then when you're in town.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then I will be at PAX Unplugged, I do believe, again, in the fall.
And then there's Lonely Me. I'll be at UK Games Expo at the beginning of June, but by that point, this podcast will already be out in the wild. So hopefully
I think you've already been to UK Games Expo.
Yeah, yeah. That was fun, he hopes. there was slight moments.
Part where you got drunk was really weird, though. Yeah, but other than that, it was
slight
great.
Slight moments of trauma, you know. Some things I just can't mention. The thing with the watermelon and the spikes. But beyond that, Gen Con, of course, I will be attending there. We keep mentioning it. I'm not going to be... God, I hope I'm not going to be crossing the Atlantic again this year for more than Gen Con. I love America, obviously, but the travel can be a bit of a drain. It's not the flight so much, it's getting to the airport. That's the thing that always gets to me, because
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I always have to catch a train up to London and then change to get to Heathrow or Gatwick, and that's always a pain in the ass. And not many other airports in the UK fly to the US. But anyway, that's a moan for another day. And then, of course, I'm sure all or most of us will be at midwinter at the very beginning of 2000.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't mention that one because you said next 6 months and I was doing the math.
Well, like, yes, oh, but like by the time this will be out, it will be within 6 months.
He's using imperial math as opposed to...
Oh, okay.
Yes, yes, proper math, because after all, what measurements don't make sense when they're in multiples of 12 or 13? and on that note, I think we will come to a close. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and you can find me on social media, as I've already mentioned, on the interview on the Onyx Path Forum, and on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer, on Twitter as Clack Click Bang, and Dixie...
Yeah, you can find me on all social media at Dixie Cyanide. Dixie like my name, Cyanide like the poison.
And Eddie?
You can find me just about anywhere at Eddie Fate, EddieFate, or at my website, eddiefate.com.
Thank you very much. And remember, everyone, many worlds, one.